everybody. My name is Helen Reite, and until the 1st of July, I'm editor-in-chief of Chatfoot.dk. As you might know, I'm going freelance, so this is also my last sort of entertainment in this program. And it has been enjoyable 5 years. And I'm very happy to introduce my last performance, Roy Brown, who's come all the way from UK, Switzerland, France, or wherever you're staying, quite a cosmopolitan. And the real reason that Roy is in Copenhagen and we've been so lucky to be able to invite him out, he has been together with 300 wild atheists in the Black Diamond, and the rumor is saying they're also leaving again, so not to worry. Roy Brown was the first who received our Freedom of Press Prize in 2006, and together with the Pakistani-Norwegian comedian Shabana Rehman. But I've known Roy for quite some years. Roy was also one of the first Europeans to really, I think, understand, appreciate, and help promoting the work of Ibn Barak, who has written the famous Why I'm Not a Muslim. But actually, you started out as an engineer. For many years, you have been a human rights activist. And let me just mention some of the things you have been doing. From the years 2003 until 2006, Roy Brown was president of the International Human and Ethical Union. Since 2004, you were also this organization's main representative at the UN. Less known, but also of great importance, is that you, together with the White Band of the Society, formed the World Population Foundation. If I'm correctly informed, it was with the purpose of improving the quality of women and their families. The life of quality of women and their families. Now, just a few things about how we would do this today. Roy will, of course, speak about the pressure on freedom of speech, about the organization of the Islamic Conference, and the headline of the topic is Why Hardline Islam and Women. But not to send people home very depressed, there's also sort of this what can one do about it. And Roy will speak for about half an hour, then there will be a short break. Anyone is very welcome. There's free coffee, and there's wine, water. And after the break, there's plenty of time for questions and answers. So please, give him a little hand.
Thank you, Hella, and thank you, everybody, for coming here. I know there are other things to do on wet Sundays, like watch football and so on, but I was glad to see that Denmark won yesterday evening. Congratulations for all of those of you who actually care. If you forgive me, I'd like to sit down and speak to you, because I can then read my script, which I can't do if I'm standing up. So, the subject of my talk is why hardline Islam is winning. Since the Iranian Revolution in 1979, Islam has become far more assertive worldwide. The Iranian Revolution showed Muslims and all over the world that Muslims could shake off what they saw as the yoke of Western economic imperialism and become the masters of their own fate. But the other thing that happened at that time was that Saudi Arabia suddenly woke up to the threat on their doorstep. And since the Iranian Revolution, Saudi has spent billions of dollars in promoting its own version of his hardline Islam worldwide. The Saudi regime is kept in place through a bargain struck with the Wahhabis, the dominant sect in Saudi Arabia. And the deal is quite simple. The family can enjoy their jet-setting Western lifestyle, but the quid pro quo is that they spend much of their nation's oil wealth promoting Islam, Wahhabi Islam. According to estimates we saw as long ago as 2004, Saudi Arabia had spent between $60 and $100 billion on this project between the Iranian Revolution and 2004. It's a process that somebody, and quite accurately in my opinion, called stealth jihad. We believe that the Saudi regime is still subsidizing hardline Islamism to the tune of between $8 and $10 billion a year. First of all, they poured money into the Organization of the Islamic Conference, the OIC, which represents the 57 Islamic states. And it has become the most influential power bloc now in the United Nations, where they have succeeded in silencing any criticism of human rights abuse in the Islamic world. I'll come back to the influence of the OIC at the UN in a moment. Also, since the early 1980s, they've been supporting local and national Islamic organizations around the world. They support the Muslim Brotherhood, CAIR, in the United States and Canada. They support the Muslim Council of Britain and the Geneva Islamic Information Center, just to mention one, which is the home of the Ramadan Brothers. And they support a myriad of mosques and Islamic information centers around the world. But most insidiously of all, they've been using their money and influence to replace liberal, moderate leadership in mosques by hardline imams. Over half of the mosques in England are now controlled by the Deoband, which is a hardline Islamist cult that originated in India. Over half the mosques in France are controlled by the Muslim Brotherhood or their sympathizers. And I heard just this week in Geneva that over the past 20 years, the Saudis have been quietly offering financial support to mosques throughout India, provided they change their imams to imams approved by them. Now, I have no information on what's happening here in Scandinavia, but I would be very, very surprised if anything different was happening here. Right across Europe, we're seeing worrying signs of a new Islamic assertiveness. Condemnation by self-appointed Islamic leaders of every perceived insult to Islam. Demands for special treatment for Muslims in schools and hospitals and the workplace. And for the acceptance of Sharia law for the settlement of family disputes. But this phenomenon is not confined to Europe. It's part of a global campaign orchestrated in large by the Organization of the Islamic Conference for the worldwide acceptance and adoption of Islamic norms and values. For the past 20 years, the OIC, which as I said represents all 57 Islamic states in the UN, has been pushing for international recognition of a unique and special status for their particular hardline interpretation of Islam. Their first step was the adoption in 1990 of the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights in Islam, which is a document which the OIC claims is complementary to the Universal Declaration, but which actually turns the Universal Declaration on its head, because it replaces individual rights by rights based exclusively on Sharia law. When I presented a paper at the UN Human Rights Council in March 2008 on behalf of IHEU, which highlighted the incompatibility between the Cairo Declaration and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, I was stopped on a point of order by the Pakistani delegate, who said, and I quote, "Any discussion of Sharia law in this forum is an insult to our faith." This extraordinary objection was actually upheld by the President of the Council. If threats to the universality of human rights cannot be addressed in the world's supreme human rights body, where can they be discussed? The OIC have since announced plans for an Islamic Charter of Human Rights based on the Cairo Declaration and a new International Islamic Human Rights Commission, a commission for which the OIC is seeking and will probably obtain UN recognition. Now, should they succeed in this, it will mean that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and international human rights law will no longer apply to more than 1 billion of our fellow human beings living in the Islamic states. But the ambitions of the OIC are not restricted to their own countries. Every year since 1999, they have introduced resolutions in the Human Rights Council, and since 2006 in the General Assembly, combating defamation of religion, with the objective of restricting all negative comment about religion, and Islam in particular. Every year, these non-binding resolutions have been adopted by the Human Rights Council with very comfortable 2-to-1 majorities, with only the liberal democracies among the 47 member states of the Council voting against. When this resolution was first introduced in the UN General Assembly, it was adopted by a similar massive majority. Freedom of expression and the idea that criticism of Islam should be permissible is anathema to the Islamic states. And the idea of combating defamation of religion has been their weapon of choice in their fight against freedom of expression. But the liberal democracies and every child of the Enlightenment understands that it is freedom of expression that underpins all our other human rights. Without freedom of expression, how can we oppose or expose the challenge of tyranny, corruption, intolerance, and so on? But there is one hopeful sign. The majority in the General Assembly for this resolution has been declining every year since it was first adopted. And the majority in the Human Rights Council has also been declining. Until this year, it was the lowest ever. But that's largely because of massive campaigning against this resolution by non-governmental organizations such as ours and many of the Western states. It turns out that that resolution runs completely counter to international human rights law. It actually undermines not only the right to freedom of expression, but it undermines religious freedom as well. So we are hopeful that we will gradually wind that majority back and that in the end it will not be adopted. But of course, the OIC have got other weapons in their locker. Since early this year, in fact last year, the OIC began pushing for what they call additional complementary clauses to the legally binding Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination that would extend protection under this convention to religions, or in other words, to Islam, thereby making defamation of religion or blasphemy a criminal offence under international law. And just 2 days ago, on Friday, they pushed through a resolution in the Human Rights Council to change the mandate of the Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Religion, requiring that defender of freedom to report on abuses of that freedom. In other words, to report on cases of Islamophobia. However unreasonable their demands might seem, and how alien to our way of life, they are winning the war in the UN and in many Western states as well. One of their key strategies has been to label any criticism of Islam or Islamic extremism as Islamophobia and to equate it with racism. In this, they were strongly supported by the former UN Special Rapporteur on contemporary forms of racism, a man called Doudou Diène. He's a Muslim from Senegal. During his term of office, he succeeded in ignoring every manifestation of the endemic anti-Semitism in the Islamic world, while focusing almost exclusively on Islamophobia, which he described as the worst form of racism on earth. The OIC were, of course, delighted with his statements, and they've been quoting him endlessly ever since. And so all-pervading has been his malign influence, that this man, 3 years after his mandate ended, is still traveling the world, advising governments from Southeast Asia to Northern Europe on how best to counter Islamophobia. Doudou Diène defined Islamophobia as an irrational fear or hatred of Islam. So no one among the hundreds of advocates of freedom of expression that I know, can be described as Islamophobic, because their fears of radical Islam, far from being irrational, it seems to me, are well-founded. But fear of being labeled Islamophobic and of violent reprisals seems to have infected governments and the media throughout the West. We see writers, comedians, politicians, playwrights, filmmakers happy to attack Christianity while steering well clear of Islam. The film 2012 that was released earlier this year is a good example. In that film, you can see the Vatican being wiped off the face of the earth, which I guess some people would find to be a good thing, but not the Kaaba in Mecca. The director, Roland Emmerich, and the co-writer, Harold Closer, admitted that they didn't want a fatwa on their heads because of a film. To see what's in store should the Islamists succeed, we need look no further than Iran or Somalia today, where under Sharia law, young children are being executed for crimes committed while they were still children. Men and women are being stoned to death for adultery. Homosexuals are being killed. Girls as young as 8 or 9 are being forcibly married to middle-aged men. Now, the Islamists are skillful at playing the victim. Yes, they are victims. But they are victims of an Islamic culture that segregates young Muslims from mainstream society, that treats girls and young women as the property of their menfolk, and shows disdain and even contempt for the very values that have enabled them to come to Europe and to prosper. I am sure that if Western employers and the media and governments were prepared to stand up for our values, far from finding opposition from the Muslim community, they would hear a collective sigh of relief that they have indeed come to a country that is proud of its values and prepared to defend them. After all, didn't the parents of these, grandparents of today's young Muslims, didn't they come here in search of a better life, away from the perpetual poverty and intolerance of those states where Islam holds sway? We must oppose every attempt by the Islamists to introduce Islamic values into our society. Those values are totally alien to the values of the Enlightenment on which our modern democratic societies have been built. We must oppose attempts to create parallel systems of justice. We must fight every step of the way attempts to create Sharia courts. Now, all of us, whether humanists, Christians, Hindus, Jews, or especially Muslims, must reject Sharia law. Because as the Islamic scholar Hassan Mahmoud has said, Muslims are the first victims of Islamic law. And unless we are very, very careful, we will be next. Europe is facing immense demographic changes, and many people are worried about what this will mean for European culture and values in the future. I would recommend to you an article by Eric Kaufman in the April edition of Prospect magazine, in which he reports on a research project that's been has produced the first really rigorous projections on the religious makeup of 16 European countries for the next 20 years. Now, even assuming European Muslim fertility declines to the level of the indigenous population by the year 2030, which frankly seems unlikely given the increasing influence of fundamentalism, then the Muslim population of Sweden will have reached about 14% by 2030. Austria will have reached 11%, and France 9%. And since most of the immigrants will be living in our largest cities, we can see that many inner cities will have Muslim majority populations long before that date. And if the assumption about declining Muslim fertility rates is wrong, and the present decline should stop, we could see far higher proportions of Muslims in our populations by 2050. So whether we like it or not, and whatever we do now, we are faced with the absolute inevitability of an increasingly Muslim population in Europe. Misguided politicians and policies of multiculturalism, allowing virtually uncontrolled immigration, have led to the creation of ghettos in our cities, with large numbers of unemployed and effectively unemployable young people. And these young people are falling easy prey to the rhetoric of the fundamentalists. So what can we do about it? Well, I'd like to start by making a few suggestions, and it seems to me, well, it seems to me to be vital, but I will then ask you for your ideas about what you think we can reasonably do as a society. First of all, I would suggest that what we should not do is attempt to return to the imagined ideal of a Christian continent because of our fear of an Islamic takeover. Frankly, talk of our Christian heritage is nonsense. Our heritage is the heritage of the Enlightenment. It was the Enlightenment that led our escape from the tyranny and bondage of medieval Christianity. What we need, and the only system, it seems to me, that will enable all Europeans to live together in reasonable peace and harmony, is genuine secularism, by which I mean complete state neutrality in matters of religion and belief. We should start by adopting a policy of zero tolerance towards incitement to hatred and towards preachers of hate. This is crucially important because incitement to hatred has been shown to play on our human capacity to hate injustice and to turn that hatred into violent action. The genocides of the Holocaust and Rwanda happened because ordinary people were inspired by their leaders to hate those who were perceived as acting unjustly towards them. We should therefore have no hesitation in acting severely against anyone who incites hatred of any group. And this applies whether the group in question is Jews, Muslims, immigrants, atheists, homosexuals, Christians, or anybody else. In fact, our governments are obliged under Article 20 of the ICCPR, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is binding law on all those states who have signed up to it, and that includes every country in Europe. They are obliged to act in this way. But unfortunately, few of them do so consistently. Hardline imams, for example, seem to have a free pass to preach hatred of the West and of Western values in many of Europe's mosques. No religion should be permitted to preach hate simply because such hatred appears in their holy texts. Religious belief cannot and must not be allowed to trump human rights or the law of the land. We also need to make clear the distinction between, on the one hand, incitement to hatred, and on the other, criticism of religion, no matter how crude or vulgar that criticism may be. Incitement should be outlawed, but criticism permitted, as part of our precious commitment to freedom of expression. We must make absolutely clear the distinction between the believer and the belief. Believers should have all their human rights protected, but beliefs are fair game. There is no human right not to be offended. Another thought is this, that harsh though it may seem, to the poor and the dispossessed. If we are going to avoid major conflicts in the future, we do need to limit immigration to the numbers that can be absorbed and assimilated into our societies. We must do far more to help members of the immigrant communities learn the skills they need to live and prosper here. But we must also recognize that the numbers we can absorb depend on their cost to society in terms of education, healthcare, social services, and, it must be said, security. However, we should support Muslim dissidents, apostates, and heretics. Groups like the Islamic Reform Movement and the Councils of Ex-Muslims, which now exist in many European countries. Last weekend, I attended a conference in Oxford called Critical Thinking for Islamic Reform. There were about 60 people there, almost all of them believing Muslims, but all of them totally opposed to the hardliners, to Sharia law, to the Muslim Brotherhood, and to the OIC. We hardly ever hear about these Muslims. I left that conference really encouraged. But unless the reformers can become the dominant voice of Islam in Europe, we are heading for serious trouble. So we must do what we can to help these dissidents. Another thought: we should not, under any circumstances, accept self-censorship. Every time an editor, out of fear, spikes an article or a cartoon that is mocking or critical of Islam or any other religion, we should publicize that fact and that it was done out of fear and not respect. We should oppose all attempts by organized religion to obtain special concessions from government. What we allow for Christianity, we cannot reasonably deny to Islam, Hinduism, or any other religion. We should oppose state funding for religious events, for faith schools. We should oppose tax breaks for supposedly charitable activities or attempts to allow religious courts to adjudicate in matters of family law. We should also promote the teaching of critical thinking. I was pleased that when our two youngest children took the International Baccalaureate, one of the compulsory subjects was the theory of knowledge, that is, a combination of philosophy and critical thinking. We should promote the teaching of ethics as rooted in an understanding of our shared humanity. All children should be taught comparative religion, including atheism and humanism, as an antidote to indoctrination. And of course, indoctrination today runs virtually unchecked through many of our schools in Europe. The teaching of ethics should be centered on the humanist ideals shared by many religions, that we are entitled to be treated with dignity, allowed personal autonomy, have equal treatment before the law, and that we should treat others as we wish to be treated. We need to promote the teaching of science for the non-scientist, an appreciation of the scientific method, of the discoveries of science, and how we know what we think we know. Respect for the scientific, evidence-based approach to life, to politics, to society, and the world around us will go a long way towards the elimination of superstition and undue religious influence in public life. We need to understand and to teach our fellow citizens that the history of European civilization is the history of the struggle for freedom, and above all, for freedom of the mind. We must not allow religion, and this time in the guise of Islam, to erode any more of our hard-earned freedoms. Thank you.
Doch, jetzt bin ich aber. Jungs, die Hände hier, die.